Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the separation of church and state when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor, a law professor, at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." He said it's worse than that. "Most of the students in this law school graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set a foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court." Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's free, and it's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, doesn't cost you anything. Now, our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. O-R-G. Well, this thing called separation of church and state has been on everybody's mind, and they're talking about it all over the country constantly. The Supreme Court, every once in a while, is being asked to make rulings on this thing of separation of church and state. And the people who are bulldozing this concept or this principle through is called the ACLU. That's the American Civil Liberties Union, and their affiliates. There's a lot of groups and organizations that are opposed to this thing of the Ten Commandments, prayer, God, and the Bible in any form being displayed or used in a public forum, you know, such as high schools or parades and city council meetings or any kind of government operations whatsoever. and they rely almost exclusively on a single letter written by Thomas Jefferson to a group of Baptists in Connecticut as the authority for this principle of law, this principle of conduct called the wall of separation. So let me read you the letter with a little introduction here from Wikipedia, I believe it is. And let's take a look at this and see, was Jefferson really telling us that he wanted to separate the Ten Commandments and God from our government? You know, it would seem like to me, just looking at it at arm's length, if there was a place where you didn't need to be too concerned about God, the Bible, prayer, or the Ten Commandments, it would be in the Mormon Tabernacle, or in the Vatican, or in your local church. It would seem like to me you got plenty of God, prayer, Ten Commandments, and Bible in places like that. One of the places that I could legitimately see excluding God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible would be from a whorehouse. I can't think of any legitimate reason why a whore or a madam in a whorehouse would want God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, or the Bible there. But if there is a place where God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible would be needed, it would seem like to me that that would be in government. You know, in our government, our Congress is permeated by bribe takers. We have lobbyists that bribe our congressmen and legislators constantly. It would seem like to me that the Bible would be a good thing to have there. Maybe Nancy Pelosi, our speaker, could turn to the section on gifts and point out to her fellow members that it's against the law to take these bribes, that it perverts the eyes of the wise. I just thought I'd throw that out there. Now, there's another little thing here that I got to thinking about, and it seems like to me that God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible might be a good place to have a copy of or some reading of in our public schools, where in times past, the greatest vices that went on in our public schools was talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothing, and not putting paper in the wastebaskets. Well, that was up until 1947, because this assault on removing God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible from our public schools began in 1947 and culminated in 1962. So in about 15 years' time, a number of cases were tried, and we accomplished our goal. We threw God out. Period. But in that period of time, from 1787 until 1962, the biggest problems we had in our public schools was talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothing, and not putting paper in the wastebaskets. Now, in case you're from some other country around the world, we have, in our public schools here in the United States, on average, we use guns in this country. See, many of you people, you don't have guns because they're outlawed in your country. But here in the United States, we don't outlaw guns, and we have plenty of them. And then our children, they take those guns from home, take them to public school, and shoot other children. Okay, you ever heard of a thing like that? Now, we never had that going on in this country in 1947, but we do today. After we took God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible out of our public schools, we now have in its place 17 major problems. They are going from the number one problem, rape, number two, robbery, number three, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, murder, suicide, absenteeism, vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang warfare, premarital pregnancy, abortions, and venereal disease. 17 major problems. Isn't the Bible, God, prayer, and the Ten Commandments aimed at solving those 17 problems of rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, and bombings, and so on? Well, it would just seem logical to me that if from 1787 to 1962 you didn't have those 17 problems, but you did have God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible in your public schools, then you took the Bible, God, prayer, and the Ten Commandments out of the public schools in 1962, and then in about 40 years, you don't have the seven previous problems of talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothing, and not putting your paper in the waste paper baskets. But instead, you now have rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, murder, suicide, and absenteeism. Has anybody ever thought that maybe if we went back to doing what we did from 1787 to 1962, that maybe that might change things? I would submit to you that it couldn't hurt anything, but it might actually help a little bit. Well, Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter, and the introduction goes like this. Thomas Jefferson was a man of deep religious conviction, and his conviction was that religion was a very personal matter, one which the government had no business getting involved in. And he was vilified by his political opponents for his role in the passage of the 1786 Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, and for his criticism of such biblical events as the Great Flood and the Theological Age of the Earth. As president, he discontinued the practice, started by his predecessors George Washington and John Adams, of proclaiming days of fasting and thanksgiving. He was a staunch believer in the separation of church and state. Jefferson wrote a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802 to answer a letter from them written in October of 1801. A copy of the Danbury letter is available here. The Danbury Baptists were a religious minority in Connecticut, and they complained that in their state, the religious liberties that they enjoyed were not seen as immutable rights, but as privileges granted by the legislature, as favors granted. Now, Jefferson's reply did not address their concerns about problems with state establishment of religion, only of establishment of religion on the national level. The letter contains the phrase "wall of separation between church and state," which led to the shorthand for what we use today called the establishment clause that we use today, separation of church and state. Now, the letter was the subject of intense scrutiny by Jefferson, and he consulted with two New England politicians to assure that his words would not offend while still conveying his message. It was not the place of the Congress or the executive to do anything that might be misconstrued as the establishment of religion. Note, the bracketed section in the second paragraph had been blocked off for deletion in the final draft of his letter sent to the Danbury Baptists. Though it was not actually deleted in Jefferson's draft of the letter, it is included here for completeness, reflecting upon his knowledge that the letter was far from a mere personal correspondence. Jefferson deleted the block he noted in the margin to avoid offending members of his political party in the eastern states. This is a transcript of the final letter as stored online at the Library of Congress and reflects Jefferson's spelling and punctuation. He starts off by saying, "Mr. President," referring to the president of the Baptist Society. "To Messrs. Nehemiah Dodge, Ephraim Robbins, and Stephen S. Nelson, a committee of the Danbury Baptist Association in the state of Connecticut. Gentlemen, the affectionate sentiments of esteem and approbation which you are so good as to express towards me on behalf of the Danbury Baptist Association give me the highest satisfaction. My duties dictate a faithful and zealous pursuit of the interests of my constituents, and in proportion as they are persuaded of my fidelity to those duties, the discharge of them becomes more and more pleasing. Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Congress thus inhibited from acts respecting religion and the executive authorized only to execute their acts. I have refrained from prescribing even those occasional performances of devotion practiced indeed by the executive of another nation as the legal head of its church, but subject here as religious exercises only to the voluntary regulations and disciplines of each respective sect. Adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation in behalf of the rights of conscience, I shall see with sincere satisfaction the progress of those sentiments which tend to restore to man all of his natural rights, convinced that he has no natural right in opposition to his social duties. I reciprocate your kind prayers for the protection and blessing of the common Father and Creator of man, and tender you for yourselves and your religious association assurances of my high respect and esteem. Signed, Thomas Jefferson, January 1, 1802. Now, you know, Jefferson, being a religious fellow himself, and saying, "I reciprocate your kind prayers for the protection and blessing of the common Father and Creator of man," and referring to his statement after having cited the First Amendment, you know, he said, the legislature enacted, this is the Congress of the United States enacted this First Amendment to our Bill of Rights, where it says, quote, "Make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Did Jefferson mean by that that he intended to eliminate God, the Bible, the Ten Commandments, and the and prayer from our Congress, from our public institutions, from our public schools? Or did he intend by that statement, build a wall of separation, to build a wall prohibiting government from interfering in our churches, to interfering with or creating a state-established religion, which is what they have in Great Britain, the Church of England? You know, oftentimes when a Supreme Court, or in fact for that matter any court, goes to construe a statute, we ask a question: what did the lawmaker intend when he made that statement? Now, an example of a statement that can be taken two ways. This statement of Jefferson here can be taken two ways. It can be taken to mean Jefferson intended to convey that he wanted to eliminate God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible from our public schools and public institutions. Or he intended to convey that he wanted to eliminate government out of religion, and that he did not want to establish a state religion or have government interfere with the churches and their mission in life or religion or religious beliefs of individuals in any way, shape, form, or manner. What was it that he intended here? Well, the ACLU has jumped on that letter and said, see, we've got to have a total separation of church and state. You can't have prayer in a public school. You can't have the Ten Commandments in your public school. We can't have the Ten Commandments or prayer in our state capitals. For instance, down in Alabama, they had a judge down there. His name was Roy Moore, and he put the Ten Commandments into the state capitol building. And my God, they ran him out of town on a rail. They said, well, we can't have that. And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, well, is that what our founding fathers... Now, keeping in mind that the Declaration of Independence was written by Thomas Jefferson, and it was signed by 56 signers of the Declaration. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, the ACLU is correct, and Jefferson, in his letter, intended, let's eliminate God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible from all vestiges of public administration. Well, does that then extend to the other 55 signers of the Declaration of Independence, or the signers of the Declaration of Association, or the Constitution of the United States, or the Articles of Confederation? I mean, he was only one 56th of the people that signed that Declaration of Independence, and maybe that was his opinion, but what was the opinion of the other 55 signers? And since when do we take one letter from one of the founding fathers and use that as the doctrine by which we're going to administer public administration for the entire nation? Would seem like to me that we ought to at least put it to a vote and come up, you know, with something like 30 members of their 30 signers of the Declaration were opposed to it, and 26 signers were in favor of it, you know, so we used to have a simple majority, don't you? Well, let's go back here and take a look at an example where this actually occurred in the Bible in Genesis chapter 2. There's a statement in here. It was written by God himself. It's in Genesis 2, verse 15, where it says, and the eternal God took the man, and he put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat of it, because in the day that you eat thereof you shall surely die. Now, listen to those words again. In the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die. Now, in the next chapter, we read a little scenario here, and it says, now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made, and he said unto the woman, yea, has God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said unto the woman, you shall not surely die, because God does know that in the day that you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be open, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, She took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together, and they made themselves aprons. Now I want you to notice here that God said, in the day that you eat thereof, and Satan said, no, in the day that you eat thereof, you will not surely die. Now, that statement can be taken two ways. One, in the day that you eat thereof, June 18th, you will surely die. Or, a second meaning would be, in the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die at some point in the future. Satan didn't lie to those people. When he said to them, in the day that you eat thereof, you will not surely die, he was telling them the truth, and on that day, they ate of it, and they didn't die. They went on to live. Adam lived to be 930 years old when he died. I don't know how old he was when he ate off the tree. Could have been 2 or 3 days. It could have been 2 or 3 years. Could have been 2 or 3 decades. We don't have a timeline there. But we do know this. God was not whistling Dixie now when he told them. He said, now in the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die, because they're both gone today. They're dead. Now, when we read a statement, sometimes the statement can be taken to mean something totally different, or we can construe it to mean something totally different. This is where lawyers really shine. They take a look at a statute, and then they come in and cite that, and they say, well, the meaning is. Now, what the judge needs to do is to go back to the original intent of the lawmaker. What did the lawmaker intend when he made that statement? So, what I'd like to do is I'd like to go back to the founding fathers and take a look at some of the statements that the founders made. What did George Washington, for instance, he was one of the founding fathers. George Mason was another one. And Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Paine, James Madison, James Monroe, Benjamin Franklin. These are all men that had something to say in our founding documents. Were they, too, of the opinion that we should separate God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Bible from our public institutions? Or were they in favor of separating our public institutions from religion? Did they intend to take the Ten Commandments out of our government? Or did they intend to take our government out of our churches? Did they intend to take government out of the religious business, and that we would not have, as a result of that, a Church of England, a state religion, like they had in Maryland, for instance? You know, Catholicism was established in Maryland. So, in order to take a look at that, let's take a look here, first of all, on page 181. Now, I'm going to cite some citations here from a book you might want to get a copy of. It's called The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law, A Study in History by William J. Federer. The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law. Do you think that the Ten Commandments have any weight or authority in the United States Code or in Vernon's Annotated Code of Missouri, for instance? Well, I'm here to tell you that it does. And there are people like William J. Federer, Sir Francis Bacon, Hugo Grotius, John Locke, Sir William Blackstone, philosophers like Montesquieu, is it Montesquieu, I think is the way you pronounce it, French guy, Edmund Burke, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Abigail Adams, Jedediah Morris, James Madison, Noah Webster, Samuel Adams, John Quincy Adams, Alexis de Tocqueville, Daniel Webster, Francis Wayland, Lyman Beecher, Wesley Merritt, J. Edgar Hoover, Woodrow Wilson. In other words, do these people, through the history of the United States, do they have something that they could add to this which would help us with our question as it deals with this thing of separation of church and state? Now, let me tell you that as of right now, there's no separation of church and state, and the state is totally dominant over the church. There are 330,000 churches in this country, and only 6,000 of them are not incorporated. Only 6,000 out of 330,000 do not have 501c3 tax exemption and therefore are free to teach what they want to teach in a public forum. Only 6,000 free churches in America and 324,000 state-controlled Christian churches. They're not all Christian. Some of them are Muslim. If your Muslim church is incorporated, if your Jewish synagogue is incorporated, then you're not free to teach what you want. Now, there was a guy out in Colorado. See if I can think of his name here in a minute. Pete Peters is his name. Has a little church out there. And they wanted to teach in a public forum their opposition to sodomy and homosexuality. They were at that time incorporated. And as a result of that, the state came in and said, you cannot teach that and shut your mouth. And they didn't, and they shut their church down and sold it at public auction. How do you like that? Which is exactly correct. I'm not sitting here arguing with it. Pastor Peters was breaking the law, and the church was subject to state control. But I wanted to point that out to you, that at that time it was one of 324,000 state-controlled, owned, and directed churches. I think Pete Peters today is one of those 6,000 free churches in America. And this thing of separation of church and state is an exact renvoi on what the Founding Fathers were attempting to accomplish. They wanted the state out of religion. They did not want religion out of the state. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are looking at a book here which is called The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law. And we're analyzing the subject matter of separation of church and state. And it was Thomas Jefferson that wrote a letter. In that letter, he made a statement. He says, making no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. It's my contention that Jefferson's intention was to separate state control of religion from the state and religion, that he did not intend to separate God, prayer, the Ten Commandments, or the Bible from our secular government, by any stretch of the imagination, in spite of the ACLU. Now, let's take a look here at some of the statements made by the founding fathers of our nation and some of the contemporary leaders of our nation that have, over the years, had something to say about our government and about the morality of government and the association of government with churches and religion and the Bible and God and Moses and so on. J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation from 1924 to 1972. And J. Edgar Hoover, on January 1st, 1895, he was born, died May 2nd, 1972. He was the American director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, we call it the FBI in this country, from 1924 to 72. He graduated from George Washington University in 1916. He earned a master's degree in law in 1917. He served as assistant to Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, and he became famous for his dramatic campaigns to stop organized crime. And J. Edgar Hoover explained, in writing the introduction to Edward L. R. Elson's book called America's Spiritual Recovery, in 1954, J. Edgar Hoover expressed himself in these words, quote, we can see all too clearly the devastating effects of the resultant secularism on our Christian way of life. The period when it was smart to debunk our traditions undermined inspiring customs and high standards of conduct. A rising emphasis on materialism caused a decline of God-centered deeds and thoughts. The American home became a place of transient, furtive living and ceased to be a school of moral and spiritual education. When spiritual guidance is at a low ebb, moral principles are accordingly in a state of deterioration. Secularism advances in periods when men forget God. But there are hopeful signs for a better day. There was hope in the words of General Eisenhower when he bowed his head on Inauguration Day and he asked in part, give us, we pray, the power to discern right from wrong and allow all our words and actions to be governed thereby and by the laws of this land. Now this humble prayer touched Americans from coast to coast. Here was hope manifested in a manner which inspired the hearts of countless millions, a president with such a deep religious sense and with such a sincere spiritual motivation, seeking to be guided by the right sets an example for all of the people. Unquote. Now, that was J. Edgar Hoover. Let me put a mark here by Hoover's name so I don't read it a second time. And then let me pick up another one here. Woodrow Wilson had this to say. He said, on October the 24th, 1914, in an address entitled The Power of Christian Young Men, delivered at the anniversary celebration of the Young Men's Christian Association in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, President Woodrow Wilson said, quote, "The only way your powers can become great is by exerting them outside the circle of your own marrow, and outside the circle of your own narrow, special, selfish interests. And that is the reason of Christianity. Christ came into the world to save others, not to save himself, and no man is a true Christian who does not think constantly of how he can lift his brother and how he can assist his friend, how he can enlighten mankind, how he can make virtue the rule of conduct in the circle in which he lives." John Foster Dulles, February 25, 1888 to May 24, 1959. He was the U.S. Secretary of State from 1953 to 1959, and during the Eisenhower administration, where he helped negotiate the peace treaty with Japan after World War II in 1950 and 51, he was a graduate of Princeton University and George Washington University. He served as an international attorney with the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell in New York from 1911 to 49. He was instrumental in the creation of the United Nations, to which he was the U.S. ambassador from 1945 to 49, and he was an interim U.S. senator in 1949. On April 11, 1955, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles delivered a speech before the 5th Annual All-Jesuit Alumni Dinner, in which he said, now Jesuit now are Catholics. He said, "Peace is a goal which men above always sought. It is a goal which we particularly think of at this Easter season when we commemorate the resurrection of the Prince of Peace. One cannot but shrink from buying peace at the price of extending over human beings the rule of those who believe that men are in fact nothing more than animated bits of matter, and that to ensure harmony and conformity they should be deprived of the capacity for moral and intellectual judgment. Man, we read in the Holy Scriptures, was made a little lower than the angels. Should man now be made little, if any, higher than domesticated animals which serve the purpose of their human masters? So men face the great dilemma of when and whether to use force to resist aggression which imposes conditions which violate the moral law and the concept that man has his origins and his destiny in God. The government of the United States has, I like to believe, a rather unique tradition in this respect. Our nation was founded as an experiment in human liberty. Our institutions reflect the belief of our founders that all men are endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights and had duties prescribed by moral law. They believed that human institutions ought primarily to help men develop their God-given possibilities, and that our nation, by its conduct and example, could help men everywhere to find the way to a better and more abundant life. Our nation realized that vision. There developed here an area of spiritual and economic vigor the like of which the world has never seen." Now, you know, that's quite a statement. You'll stop and think about it. Now, these are some of our more modern leaders. These are the people, you know, that have been running the country in the, you know, before 1962, but in that pivotal area between 1947 and 1962, when this concept of separation of church and state was instituted in this country. Let's go back a little bit and take a look at Sir Francis Bacon. Sir Francis Bacon, born January 22, 1561, he died April 9, 1626, was the Baron Verulam, Viscount St. Albans, and Lord Keeper of the Great Seal under King James I. As Lord Chancellor of England from 1618 to 21, he was significantly responsible for the formulation and the acceptance of the scientific method, which stressed gathering data from experimentation and induction rather than through the practice of philosophical deduction promulgated by Aristotle. Sir Francis Bacon was responsible for helping to found the Royal Society of London. Here's what he said. There never was found in any age of the world either philosophy or sect or religion or law or discipline which did so highly exalt the good of the community and increase private and particularly good as the holy Christian faith. Hence it clearly appears that it was one of the same God that gave the Christian law to men and gave the laws of nature to the animals. Sir Francis Bacon. Notice that each and every one of these philosophers, politicians, and statesmen have nothing against God, the Bible, or religion. And in fact, as we progress along, I'm going to show you that, in the words of George Washington, for instance, in his farewell address, he said the very concept of trying to divorce morality from government is preposterous on its face. Now, that's precisely what we have done here in this country. We have, in fact, divorced God from our government. Now, I'm asking the question, do you really think that that's a good idea? Are you really sure that that's what you want to do? Because every act now has a reaction. These decisions that we make have outcomes. They have consequences. Has anybody ever told you what the consequence of forgetting that old covenant contract that we had with our God, and with that contract and its influence on American law, and then the abolition of the terms and conditions of that contract? Do you think that there might be some consequences, even if you've never heard what those consequences might be? And would you be interested in listening to what those consequences are going to be? Not from my opinion. I don't want to impress you here with my wisdom and my judgment. I just wanted to point out that the Creator himself said there's a consequence coming from this action. Now, he told Adam and Eve plainly, he said, now listen, boys and girls, there's going to be a consequence from your action here. And he told them very plainly, he says, don't eat off that tree. Now, another guy came in on the scene and he said, hey, listen, let me give you my interpretation. In the day that you eat thereof, you will not surely die. Besides that, you're going to be real smart and you're going to be wise and you're going to get all these great benefits from eating off that tree. Satan wasn't lying. He telling them the truth. Now, he deceived them by telling them the truth. Yeah, they were deceived, and they went ahead and ate off the tree, and they had a consequence, and that consequence affects me. It affects you. It affects Sir Francis Bacon and John Foster Dulles and J. Edgar Hoover. All of them died, and there's one certainty. I am going to die. Now, that was not a good consequence, and I'm sorry as hell that that happened, but you know, that's where this chess game is. We lost our queen. Game's not over but we're going to play the rest of the game without a queen. Now that's the way that consequence came down. So now it's recovery time. So I want to give you a couple of more of these citations here in this segment, and then we'll take a look as we progress along at the other side of the coin. What is the meaning of this separation of church and state referred to by Thomas Jefferson? Because I don't believe for a minute that Jefferson intended to remove God from the Congress of the United States. As a matter of fact, to this day, every session of Congress is opened by prayer. Now, why would you open a session of Congress with prayer, but you'll open a session of school with evolution? Now, those people that are in the Congress today were educated in our public school system, and as a consequence of that, they are lacking in morals. They are amoral at best and immoral at worst, as evidenced by the way they vote and the way they conduct themselves. It would seem like to me that if we're going to maintain an institution of prayer in the Congress, that we ought to extend that custom of prayer like President Eisenhower did, and George Washington, and John Adams did. So, you know, I'm not here to suggest, you know, that we impose Mormonism, you know, on the Congress, or that we impose Mormonism or Catholicism upon our students in public school. That never was the intention of our founding fathers. In fact, it was just exactly the opposite. They said, we don't want any state-financed or state-sponsored religion. But that doesn't mean that they intended to take morality out of our schools, or that they intended to abrogate our contract with our God, or that they intended to remove the Ten Commandments from our public institutions and from our schools and from our youth, nor that we should take the Bible and throw it away. Now, that's what we've done. I don't deny it. But was that a good outcome? And is that really what our founding fathers intended? That's what the ACLU says they intended. But as I pointed out, you can construe this in two ways. And as I've already showed you, hey, wait a minute. Now, this isn't exactly what our founding fathers said. So let's listen to a couple more. There's a guy by the name of Hugo Grotius. President James Madison described Hugo Grotius as the father of the modern code of nations. Hugo Grotius was born on April the 10th, 1583, died August 28th, 1645. He was a Dutch jurist. He was a Dutch judge. He was a theologian and a statesman who was considered the founder of the science of international law. In 1607, being 24 years old, he was appointed advocate general for the provinces of Holland and Zeeland. In 1613, at the age of 30, he became the chief magistrate of Rotterdam. In 1619, Prince Maurice of Nassau sentenced him to life imprisonment for his support of the Armenian faith. And 3 years later, with his wife's help, he escaped to France, hidden in a linen chest. Hugo Grotius, or Hug de Groot in Dutch language, published De Jure Bel de Pactis on the Law of War and Peace in 1625, which was a study of the laws of mankind in reference to individuals, nations, and states. From 1635 until his death, he served as the Swedish ambassador to France. In his work on the Law of War and Peace, Hugo Grotius said this. He said, among all good men, one principle, at any rate, is established beyond controversy, that if the authorities issue any order that is contrary to the law of nature or to the commandments of God, the order should not be carried out. For when the apostle said that obedience should be rendered to God rather than men, they appealed to an infallible rule of action, which is written in the hearts of all men. Now that statement comes from Acts 5, verse 29, where we're instructed to obey God rather than men. John Cotton, December 1585 to December 1652, was a powerful Puritan minister and scholar in Boston. Born in England, he fled to the colonies in 1632 to avoid religious persecution. There, he rose to become perhaps the most influential leader in shaping the destiny of Puritan New England, serving at the First Church of Boston from 1633 to 52, known for his didactic writings. The principles stated in his sermons were frequently put into immediate practice by civil authorities. In 1636, Reverend John Cotton gave the outline for a code of laws which included the phrase, "the law of nature delivered by God." And you will find that line in many of our state constitutions and in many of our laws and in many of our public writings. In fact, our revolution was spearheaded by the church. It was not spearheaded by secular leaders, by Nancy Pelosi's and Harry Reid's and Barack Obama's. It was spearheaded by religious men and ministers and preachers like this John Cotton. Now, how do you like that? Or as I like to say from time to time, isn't that just real special? Now, a copy of this book, which is written by William J. Federer, called The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law, A Study in History. See where you can get a copy of that. Let's see here, copyright 2003. No prior permission is necessary to reproduce 5,000 words or less. The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law. Put out by AmeriSearch Incorporated, P.O. Box 20163, St. Louis, Missouri, 63123. Phone is toll-free, 1-888-USA-WORD. That's 1-888-USA-WORD. I'll look up the number next time. You can probably also get a copy of this from our friends at BraveNewBookstore.com. Possibility you might be able to find it at a Christian bookstore. And there's also a possibility you might be able to find a copy of it at Barnes & Noble, especially if you were to ask for The Ten Commandments and Their Influence on American Law, A Study in History, William J. Federer, F-E-D-E-R-E-R. Oftentimes, that's all you need. Give it to the boys at Barnes & Noble and have them order you a copy. Hey, I'm about out of time, and I have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, around the world, in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.